Hi, this is John Erickson, and welcome back to the second installment of the Advanced Ball Striking interview with former PGA Tour winner and U.S. amateur champion Sam Randolph. Sam and I will be discussing some of the modern swing thoughts on the golf swing, and we're going to be taking a look at Sam's experiences down at Augusta National when he was the low amateur twice in the Masters tournament. Sam, let's talk a little bit about some of these modern swing fads, stack and tilt, the X Factor, one plane swing.
You know, we never even have heard about anything called the X Factor until Jim McClain invented it in the 90s, right?
Right.
And he's explained to me at a meeting before how they took it and tweaked it around different than what he really added. His study was actually pretty good. Anyway, this X Factor's not correct. I mean, they didn't restrict hip turns. They were letting their left heel come off the ground. They were turning so much for years and years and years, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Johnny Miller, Jack Nicklaus, Al Geiberger, Tom Watson, the heels coming up to make a huge turn, every guy.
Right. Yeah, absolutely, because it's all about creating range of motion. You need range of motion.
So then we started saying, keep your feet on the ground, restrict your hip turn, the X Factor. And then all of a sudden, after people had done that, the X Factor's wrong, so it causes you to get stuck. And then the term get stuck starts coming out in the year 2000, right? Now we hear all this, oh, he's stuck. And they keep thinking stuck is too far inside, which is impossible if you're in sync. So being stuck is more being out of sync than it is being off plane. There's been a big misunderstanding there. And so here we go, coming full circle back to figuring everything out. Mac O'Grady, Jerry Hogue, you know, the anatomy, the physics, the geometry, and figuring. You come back to a pretty darn close version of what I used to do without knowing it.
Well, you certainly don't have to convince me that what you were doing at the peak of your game was fundamentally correct and right. You were a fantastic ball striker. Now, I know you certainly had that big forearm rotation, sweep it inside kind of backswing. When you talked about cranking it on the inside, really just rotating the forearms, right? Getting a great forearm rotation going back.
Yeah, and, you know, I copied that too. So you could see how my swing would change a little bit because I would imitate the guys who were the best. And I got taught early on to get the club in the slot halfway down and was shown pictures of Hogan and Snead and Byron Nelson, and they all put the club right in the slot on the way down. And boy, looking back, that was a huge thing. That's the most common fundamental I've seen among good ball strikers. Somehow it's not a fundamental, but in my book it is.
Well, it certainly is, and I love how George Knutson described it as hitting out of his right hip pocket.
Yeah.
And your golf swing really, really looked like that to me in college. You know, you really had it cranked down in there where that club, the shaft looked like it was feeding right out of your right hip pocket coming into the impact. It was great stuff.
Yeah, crank it up, and then it was all about coming down and through. And then after being on the tour for several years and having some success, but also struggling a little bit to get better and find that higher level, I went to some top instructors and ended up with Hank Haney a little bit there for a couple of years, and he's big against taking the club back inside, and we basically radically changed my backswing, and looking back at it, it actually made my swing worse.
Right.
And, you know, I think partly when I left working with him, it probably overcooked where he was trying to take me just a little bit because it took such a radical exaggeration to make it change in the first place, but it's not really so. There's been so many different backswings that have played good golf that it didn't work out very good for me. My game went back a notch instead of forward a notch.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about the backswing because, you know, you see the guys that crank it inside like Raymond Floyd and George Knudsen, and then even Mo Norman, you know, kind of pulled it inside. In fact, Mo showed me how he would drag the club on the ground for 42 inches before the club would actually leave the ground. Pretty interesting stuff. And then you got the guys go the other way, the Trevinos and the Furyks, and the guys that just pick it up and hoist it.
We could come up with 10 different versions of backswings that have all played successful golf.
Yeah. I've always felt the real transition isn't so much at the top, but it's really coming from the slot into impact.
the slot or the delivery zone to be able to just let you let her fly and freewheel it to get through the impact zone and find a ball flight pattern that you can work with, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I find that you don't have to aim perfect either. I mean, stand where you need to stand to get your pattern to work.
Yeah, that's a really good point, too, because, you know, when you look at Trevino, I mean, it was just kind of a step, 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 boom, each fire. You know, he wasn't taking too much time trying to get lined up perfectly.
Yeah.
It really became a game of feel at that point, where you start to feel the position of your body over the ball, and then you start feeling the shot out towards your target, and it's not about vector lines and lasers and all this sort of thing.
After all, we're standing on the side of the ball swinging in a circle.
Right. And what was that saying you mentioned?
One of my favorite little sayings I came up with is Confucius say, golfer who tries to swing online hits ball in circles.
Right.
Golfer who swings in circles hits ball online.
That's great. Boy, isn't that the truth?
So, it's true too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But let's say before you made these changes, when you mentioned that you were really on with your irons or really off with, let's say in 1984, 85, a week that you were really on with your irons or a week that you were a little bit off with your irons, what do you think was the difference?
Well, part of it was my setup would move around a little bit on me and wasn't consistent week in, week out as much as it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I would usually just make the adjustment in my setup and leave my swing alone in the old days.
Right.
And then it got to the point where you're trying to make your swing better to do it.
Right,
right. It didn't work as well.
So you would change ball position a little bit or...
Yeah.
Or how you would set up your upper body, a little more spine tilt or...
Yeah, and I didn't think I needed to be able to fade my irons. You know, if you go by the way Ben Hogan would think... You shape the shot according to what the course asks for. If the pin's on the left, you draw it in off the middle of the green. If it's on the right, you fade it in off the middle of the green. Well, trying to do that took me away from my little fade the driver, draw the iron, and just try to get the thing on the green. You know, if the pin's on the right, just hit it at the pin and let it draw if it wants to and putt from the middle of the green, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to change your swing to hit a fade in there.
Right, because, I mean, there's been a lot of great players that have kind of played sort of one shot, you know, and just...
Yeah, I would end up hitting push fades too many times, and that just brings in to play what you're trying to eliminate.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no doubt, Sam, that in the 80s, you were definitely doing things the right way.
At the same time, my swing got in the slot, so it was good. See what I mean?
Yeah, I remember you mentioning to me that you really felt a lot of legs in your swing.
Yeah, probably a little too much. That's where I had a lot of reverse C, and if I show you those old pictures, you go, oh, no wonder your back got hurt right here. But, you know, I think that reverse C leg swing was effective for good ball striking, but hard on your back. Right. Lee Trevino, and Lee Trevino didn't do it a little bit. Nicholas had a lot of back and hip trouble doing that.
Yeah, really kind of thrusting the hips going through.
Yeah.
Rather than finishing more sort of erect like Byron Nelson did, right? Like he was able,
right.
Nelson was able to kind of drive his legs down to the ball, but then he sort of rotated flat and around and up, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the issue of what swings better for your back is a debate out there right now. You know, with the new stack and tilt swing, they claim that's better for your back, but... You know, then other teachers will say, no, it's not, it's worse for your back, and the poor people listening to the experts are wondering what the heck the truth is.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't like the stack and tilt. I've made that well known on my website, that's for sure.
Okay, well, I've spent time with Andy Plummer and Mike Bennett, and they're good guys, and
mm-hmm.
they've studied a lot with Mac O'Grady, and they think it's the single pivot move, right?
Well, I mean, you can do it with the short irons, but I'd love to see any stack and tilters, you know, pull out like a one iron and try and hit it off a tight lie.
No way.
You know, I mean, I think my theory on stack and tilt is that, you know, it's basically how we used to hit short irons, and now with the modern gear, you can kind of get away with it, sort of using
yeah.
a wedge swing to hit a hybrid.
You know what the fact is? I heard that just this summer somewhere that the stack back and tilt guys are actually starting to let their guys move to the right a little bit more on the way back for their drivers.
Well, they kind of have to, because the guys on tour that are using it are down at the bottom of the stats.
Yeah, because, I mean, if we go on there and go, look, there's no such thing as anybody even doing it.
And the guys that claim to do it are all 160th in driving accuracy and all that.
And their spines are still tilted backwards because their head and hips are counterbalancing each other to keep them from falling down.
I know Bradley, you know, he hates it, and he gave a big lecture to Aaron Baddeley about it and said, you got to stop doing that. And Aaron apparently jumped ship, I guess.
Oh, he has, yeah.
After talking to Bradley.
If there's a few guys loving it, Charlie Wee and a few others, there's also triple that number that ran into trouble trying it.
I think it's a product of the modern gear. If you took a wedge, basically a wedge swing, you know, you could probably get away with it with a hybrid or something, but you couldn't get away with it with like a, you know, with a heavy.
It might help you into your, down to your 6-iron, then it's basically over. But the stack part is a little dangerous because your spine stacking vertically, vertebrae one over another, actually takes the body out of balance when you study the anatomy. Because, you know, I've been had it proven to me with people that are experts in the anatomy that your head and hips have to counterbalance each other for you to not fall over. And that puts the spine at a little bit of a tilt back angle. The tilt part's always been there when you finish. They've been doing that since 1920.
Right.
So I think that if you just think of it as a centered turn and then there's a little tilt in your finish, it would be basically correct, but you couldn't, you know, get everybody's attention that way. It'd be too simple. And so I liken it to this with people trying to reinvent the golf swing when it's been these fundamentals, as you see them, have been going on for ages. Is if you like chocolate ice cream, and someone tells you, oh, you got to go down to the new ice cream store and try this new ice cream. It's the greatest of all time. It's double the price, but it's so good you got to go try it. It's called Bavarian Mousse, right? Bavarian Mousse. What the heck gets your attention, right? You wonder what it is. You go get it. You eat your ice cream cone, and you look over to your friend, and you go, you know what? That just tasted like good chocolate ice cream. What are they talking about here?
Right.
But they got you to pay double for their chocolate ice cream, didn't they? And the poor golfers out there that don't know better can get sucked into this so easy. My job as a teacher is to show people the way to discovering their own best swing that has to come through the slot and helping them discover it, but even more importantly, being a filter for them so I can filter out all the crud that interferes with just doing a fairly simple job, you know?
What do you think, you know, about, you know, the heavier gear we used to swing compared with the lightweight stuff now? Because, you know, my thought is that the heavier gear helps you get the club in the slot.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that, obviously, a little bit lighter shaft, you can swing a little faster.
Mm-hmm.
But there comes a point where you lose control of hitting the ball straight. Because, see, the shaft, there's mass between the grip and the club head to help you have more control. And if you take too much of the mass away in the shaft, it becomes too much of a just throw the club head at the ball thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can lose control trying to go faster. So everybody has to find their point where that balances out.
Now, I know you mentioned you're working on some kind of new body training and fitness stuff.
You know, fitness is a thing nowadays that we're way more onto. Heck, when I was in college, we worked out with a football team and did just the basic weights and go running and all that. Now we've got golf-specific workouts and strengthening stuff, and I've been working with a real good trainer here in Fort Worth that works with a handful of tour players and got me doing some stuff I've never done before, and I'm actually feeling better. I don't want any surgery.
How are these fitness programs put together, and, you know, who's putting them together as far as the exercises that they're coming up with and this sort of thing? Are these being designed by players or more people that are just in the physiology department studying?
I would say physical therapists and golf pros have been putting their two heads together for a while.
Okay.
And then they're also using science, and I think Titleist Performance Institute, TPI, probably has the biggest program, but there are other people that know that program and are studying with folks in other countries and training coaches with other sports, and people are learning more all the time. And so I find that the program I've been in with guys at Back Nine Fitness, they're excellent, based here in Fort Worth. I find it even a little further, taking it a little further than TPI, because it's more personalized for me. They put you through a full assessment, basically testing every range of motion and strength issue that you have to find your imbalances, and then build a program to get you in balance with your flexibility and strength. And it can have, you know, because I lost the ability to turn like I used to, and I'm getting some of it back right now. I probably won't ever get all of it back, but the more the merrier.
You're saying on the backswing, like you're, how far you can turn your shoulders?
And turn into my right hip, too.
Oh, okay.
And to get everything all the way around my right leg loaded into my hip.
So how has your golf swing changed from when I saw you in the 80s to what you're doing now?
Well, my backswing goes back pretty much on plane. I don't even think about it. Haven't in years. I just leave it alone. It goes just fine. And you would see a little bit refined version of what you remember, and maybe a little bit shorter backswing, and maybe a little less leggy and reverse C to get through the ball, mm-hmm. A little more on top of it, and a little more trying to, you know, rotate the upper torso a little more upon more supportive lower body.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Try and, you know, take pressure off the back.
And then when you say your backswing on plane, so what you're saying is you're not really cranking it inside like you used to with the big forearm rotation going back?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I just swing back up and swing through, and it's the transition that makes all the difference for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hank Haney thinks that you can swing the club up and down the same exact swing plane. We watch, you know this, all we right. Watch the best strikers. Downswing plane is lower and narrower than the backswing plane. You know?
Absolutely.
So I'm not sure you can swing the club on... Actually, I don't think you can swing the club on one plane.
No, you can't. You can't do it.
Not literally. I mean, I understand Jim Hardy's a good teacher, and he's trying to tell us that he wants your arm on line with your shoulder plane, and that's a flatter version of a swing, and then there's a more upright version, so you don't have to do it one way, and that's good. To actually literally swing on one plane, you can't do that, I don't think, effectively.
Yeah, nor would you want to, really.
Yeah, so, and the X factor thing that Jim McClain came along with, restricting our lower body in the 90s. All the old players lifted their heel up and turned the most they could, had freedom, and then we're keeping our feet down and restricting our hips. And Ernie Els can do it nicely, but I can't turn like that. And what's interesting to me is that the term stuck never even existed in the 80s or even early on in the 90s. It wasn't until everybody tried to do the X factor. They restrict their hips going back, and then when they go forward, their hips are out in front of them too early, too fast, you know? And then the club is late. Then you're always trying to fix stuck.
I kind of see that as, you know, not having enough spine tilt, you know, and what I would say, you know, from a caddy view, you know, that your spine is sort of tilted over your right foot. And then what that does is it allows room for your arms to travel as they come down on the downswing.
That's correct. That's why you can't stack your spine. You're threatening your balance.
Yeah. And that's, if you look at the, you know, great ball strikers, they're all have a lot of spine tilt. It's not so much that the spine is tilted, leaning to the right, as it is your torso is rotated and then bent over a little bit at the waist to allow the room for, it's a passageway for the arms to come back down. And then...
Correct. And the head and the hips counterbalance. I actually first learned that from a dance instructor.
Oh, interesting.
Taking ballroom dancing lessons with my wife on a cruise ship. And then I had it proven to be absolutely true by our friend Jerry Hogan from mm-hmm. Australia, who's a whiz on the anatomy, how it relates to swinging the club.
Yeah, Jerry's been over on our website too. He's really made some great posts and some real insightful stuff on there.
Yeah, I learned some good things studying with him there a few years ago, and it's very true that if you go against Mother Nature, you're going to lose, you know, break the laws of physics. people are blown away when you tell them that Jim Furyk, his swing actually complies with the laws of physics.
Oh, absolutely. I love Jim Furyk's swing. But, you know, I'm really looking at it from, you know, his downswing, you know, through impact and beyond. He's just, it's fabulous. It's just wonderful action going on there.
Yeah, repeats itself endlessly. He's great.
Yeah, and you've got to be able to, like you said, you've got to be able to repeat the swing.
Yep. Great game, isn't it? Here's a quote that I love. It says it's by Arnold Palmer here. I'm not sure. Doesn't really matter who said it, but here it is. Golf is deceptively simple and endlessly complicated. It satisfies the soul and frustrates the intellect. It is at the same time rewarding and maddening. It is without a doubt the greatest game mankind has ever invented. I like that.
Let's talk a little bit about how you said you learned to curve and shape the ball and the importance of that at a young age.
Oh yeah, you know what we used to do as kids in Al Geiberger's house? We had a course set up that went through the house and we played it with ping pong balls and a 9-iron. And so if you're going down the hallway and to the right, the guy that could put cut spin on it to make it spin around the corner could get a half shot advantage because you had to go down the hall and into another room. We had par fours and fives. It was good stuff because you can really spin a ping pong ball.
That's a good lesson there, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I'll give guys ping pong balls. You in winter months, you can't go to the course. Well, here, you got a 9-iron and some carpet and about 10 yards of room.
That'll really tell you how that ball is spinning, whether you're cutting it or drawing it or even...
Yeah, plus you can spin it back if you can hit it far enough. That's pretty cool. Yeah. And you have to strike down on it or you'll never spin it.
Well, it's certainly interesting, Sam, that you are naturally left-handed. So how did you end up playing golf right-handed when you're left-handed?
I think I probably played baseball first and probably didn't have left-handed clubs, so I just learned with a right-handed club and batted right. I pitched left-handed and batted right-handed in baseball.
Really? So you throw left-handed?
Throw left-handed, bat right-handed, kick right-footed. I was a punter on the football team, kicked off, punted, right-footed.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you think about that, you know, I'm sure Jerry Hogan probably went over that with you, but... You know, if you've got a strong right leg to post off in the golf swing, but you're left-handed, so your left shoulder and torso muscles are more developed, well, that's kind of a winning combination, isn't it?
It is, and with the injuries in my back and hip on my right side, I don't quite have the explosive stuff that I used to in my right leg and stuff. I'm trying to get a little bit of that back.
Yeah, I remember you really looked like you fired your right side really nicely through the shot, you know. Well, that's certainly some interesting thoughts on the golf swing. We'll be talking more about the golf swing as we move on. Let's talk about your experiences down at Augusta and the Masters. So, you play, you win the U.S. Amateur, you get an invite to the Masters, and you were the low amateur in the Masters not once, but twice.
Yes.
So, what was it like going out to Augusta the first time? You're playing in the Masters. You know, you're playing some great golf at this time. You know, how are you able to, you know, stay focused out there from just, you know, the awe of just walking around, you know, the hallowed grounds of Augusta, as compared with you
good
know,
question. To me, it was like, you know, a kid on Christmas morning or showing up at Disneyland for the first time ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so exciting, I didn't really think about the stuff that the media might get you thinking about when you listen to that. But, and 85, the first one was, I was real fortunate, the pairings I got. I remember getting to play, I knew Ola Sobel, Jose Marie from junior golf. As a matter of fact, we played each other in those Junior World Cup matches.
Oh, okay.
And I saw him there at his first Masters, and he hooked up a game with Seve and Gary Player. We had a little match. It was Jose and myself against Seve and Gary Player. And that was a great practice round because I just shadowed Seve playing different shots around the green to where the pins are going to be in the tournament.
Mm.
And what a short game lesson that was.
Yeah, I bet, huh?
I thought I was pretty good with my sandwich till I started watching that. And that was real fun. I remember having some other good practice round partners, Johnny Miller, Arnold Palmer even joined us the last three holes coming up, and I had a real good first round, 70, the first round, playing with Gay Brewer, who was an old-timer then, and being in, like, fifth place, I got paired with Tom Watson the second round, and he was leading at the end of the second round. I had slipped back into maybe 10th or 15th or something, and got paired with Jack Nicklaus on Saturday.
Wow.
And just a good little story here about playing under pressure or being nervous, or, you know, we can hear the sports psychologist tell us, just relax and try to have fun, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, is that realistic if you're teeing off on the first hole of your first Masters? I mean, so I remember that Saturday coming up on the putting green and saying, hello, Mr. Nicklaus, I'm Sam Randolph, and he said, that's my dad, call me Jack. And he hit first off the first tee, now driving Jack Nicklaus, and hits it down the middle. And you, from watching on the outside, you can't tell he's nervous.
Right.
But, you know, I got up there, and oh, heck yeah, I was nervous. And I didn't hit a very good drive. I actually kind of hit a little bit of a heel fade up there, just short right of the fairway bunker on the first hole, and chipped it out, and was on a tree root with bugs flying. It seemed like it took an hour for me to play the first hole. Somehow I wedged up there 6 feet and made it for a par. And we're going down the second fairway, and I asked Jack. I said, let me go back one. This was the next day. Anyway, we finished this round, and we both shot even par, so I got to play with him again on Sunday. I somehow thought I could not be as nervous on the first tee. So I tried to convince myself, this is no big deal. I've done it now 3 days in a row. I played with Watson. I'm going to just get up there and rip it like I'm back at home on my home course, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so on the putting green Sunday morning, I walked up and I said, good morning, Jack. And putted, and he hit first off the first tee again, and I got up there and I teed my ball up. I took some practice swings, and I'm convinced I'm just going to get up there and let her rip. It's not going to be so scary this time, right?
Right.
Nice try. As soon as I addressed the ball and started moving my feet a little bit, everything, you know, the hands got sweaty, the knees were shaking, and I'm going, oh no, here it comes again. And at this point, I can't just back off because I've convinced myself I'm going to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I hit a little hook into the pine straw on the left trees off that first hole and hit it over the green and the gallery and was dead. I ended up making six. And now we're going down the second fairway on Sunday, and I asked Jack, I said, hey, how nervous are you going off the first tee, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at me and he says, the day I'm not nervous going off the first tee, I retire. And I went, okay, you're supposed to be nervous, you dummy. What are you trying to not be nervous? So I would have hit a better drive, probably, most likely would have hit a better drive, if I would have just expected to be nervous, but maybe knew how to breathe and calm myself down just a little better, and then just handle the nerves and know that nervousness actually can make you focus better, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of get more scared, so.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree with that, yep.
So there's your sports psychology. If you think you're just going to walk up there in your first Masters and just, woohoo, I just have fun, see the target letter go like it's my home course, you're, it's a fairy tale.
You know, one of the things I know, you know, what I did when I started to, you know, work a little bit on my golf swing is I tried to, you know, tighten up my swing to where I could build it around a firmer grip pressure, you know, and more tension in my body so that when I got nervous, this was something I was more comfortable swinging the club, gripping it tighter and being more firm in the body as compared
to... You're accepting the fact.
Yes.
The other thing is that you have to be holding on the club fairly firm when you go through impact or it'll fly out of your hands.
That's right. That's right.
And I remember having this talk with Byron Nelson personally, when he was still alive and coming out to lunch and talking to the corporate groups where I do some golf schools out here at the Four Seasons in Dallas. And he talked about holding the club, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, more like a 6. He says, you're going to be holding onto it when you go through the bottom. Why not hold onto it the whole way? And it made sense because if you try to hold on too light, then you got to grab back on to have, you know, control of it at the bottom. And we know what grabbing onto the club does on the downswing.
So let me ask you this. So you're you're playing in the Masters, you know, when you're playing your practice round or the first round, you know, as good as you were playing at that time, I mean, did you feel like if you played really well that you could have won the tournament?
That's a good question. I did not. The first time I just wanted to make the cut, and then once I made the cut, I was just trying to, my goal was to, you know, try to just shoot under par on the course. I was just playing my own game on the course, really. But I do remember after having a good year the first year and finishing on it, what, 17th or 18th, something like that. I think I was like 6 or 7 or something off the lead at the end. So the second year, I remember thinking, you know what, if I were to do everything really good and have a hot week with my putter, it's actually possible to win this thing. That would actually be a possibility. So
I kind of feel like you have to feel it's a possibility for it to happen. What do you think?
Yeah, but why I say a possibility is, I mean, if any athlete, any sport could guarantee he's going to play good every time before the game, then we'd be talking about that guy right now. There isn't one.
Knowing in your, you know, inside you that it's a possibility that you
that
could
I
win.
Could possibly play good enough to do that.
Yeah, that it's possible allows that possibility to be, in a sense, possible.
Yep.
You know, if you don't feel like it's a possibility that you can win, you know, I mean, how many times did you win a tournament where you thought, no, there's no way I could win this tournament?
Oh, man. I mean, it can go either way. You could be 6 shots ahead. I remember in the NCAA championship having about a 5-shot lead with 10 holes to go and ended up losing in a playoff. And I didn't necessarily play bad. I think I did make one double bogey, one bad swing, but other than that, was still playing just fine, and the other guy got hot. I think it was Clark Burrows, yeah.
That would have been at Greenleaf, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was down there, too.
There's other times where you could be 5 shots behind starting the last day, and you don't expect much, and you get it going and shoot a 66, and, ooh, look at this. Now you're in a playoff to try and win the thing. I don't know, anything other than just play the holes you have to play as good as you can till they're out of them. There's no more left, and then add them up, and there you go. And then what can you learn from the experience and move on and do it again in the next one, you know?
So how was it, you get to be in the butler cabin there, right, when you're the low amateur in the Masters?
Yeah.
So that must have felt pretty special, huh?
It was the most exciting in 86 because that was the year that Nicklaus had his 30 on the back nine to win the tournament, one of the most exciting sporting events ever, and so that was pretty exciting. But to be honest with you, back then I wanted to shoot in the 60s on the course, then the second Masters, and wasn't really as concerned with the low amateur thing. And I remember having good rounds going and letting it get away a little bit and coming in with 72, and I was a little irritated I didn't do that, and I wanted to just go back to our rent house and watch the end of the tournament, and they said, no, you can't leave, you're going to get low amateur, you got to stay around for the presentation, you know. So I just, you know, I mean, I'm 21 years old, so
yeah.
It ends up that we watched the finish of the tournament in one of the cabins alongside the 10th fairway. And that was quite an experience looking back now. We had no idea what was going to happen, but that was when Nicklaus is shooting 30 on the back nine, and you'd hear the roar come up through from Amen Corner through the trees, just when he would do something. And then just a couple minutes later, they'd post his score change up on the scoreboard on 18 green, and everybody'd go again, and this kept going on and on.
Really?
So at Augusta, the first hole used to be 405, I think it was, 400, right in there. And now it's 445 or 440. So they've added 40 yards to some of these tees. And in my opinion, you know, the old school player like Gary Player will say, oh, they're just trying to make you hit the same club into the green that we used to. Well, Gary Player never hit it very far to be comparing to today's player. I mean, if today's player is hitting the same club as Gary Player did back then into the green, they got to make the hole 50 yards longer. So the Augusta National course now plays even a little bit longer. I mean, let's say the equipment goes 30 yards farther, but the hole's 40 yards longer, see? So it's a monster out there.
Yeah, and I, you know, my thought is it's not quite as exciting as it used to be, because I like the the risk and reward element to where a guy could shoot 30 on the back nine, you know, if he really got it going.
You know what they've done? I have some friends that that are members, and so they last year on purpose have moved some of the tees up. In other words, the new seventh hole is so long, they've extended the front of the tee forward, so if the weather is such, they can put the tee up more and make guys still have a reasonable club into the green. Or the 15th hole, if it gets into the wind or if it rains, they can move the tee up 20 yards so the guys still go for it in two. And so they purposely made the pin placements a little bit more accessible and moved some tees up just a little bit so there'd be more birdies and eagles and the scores were lower. And you saw that last year in last year's Masters. Plus, the weather was good, so I thought they brought it back to where it should be really nicely in the last year or two. But for a couple years there, it was a combination of the course being maxed out and the weather being difficult during the tournament week. And, you know, Zach Johnson won the thing at shooting one over, tied for the highest score in history.
Right, right.
That was only 3 years ago, yeah. So I think it'll be good now that you just have to be able to adjust to make it play the way it's supposed to.
Let's talk a little bit about what you got going down at the Masters every year. You and our buddy Bobby Schaefer, you guys bring some people down there.
Yeah, we've got a great trip down there. First class trip to the Masters, in my opinion, the greatest event in sports. I still get the hairs up on the back of my neck and the chills when I go in there and look down that 10th fairway. Even though I don't have my clubs, I'm just a host and helping people make their way around and have the best time possible. That never goes away. It's interesting. And I've asked the other guys, I said, do you feel like this too? Because I'm wondering, is it just because I had neat past experiences, or is this like this for everybody? And my friends that never played in it say, oh, me too, me too. So what we do is Bobby Schaefer started doing this 12 years ago with his sponsor when he was playing, and some clients and folks, and they rented homes and got some tickets, and it grew and grew and grew. And I started coming out there in 2007. I was a guest speaker telling about my amateur experiences and brought a couple people along and my dad and checked it out. And you know, Bobby had been telling me, you got to do this with me, bring people to the Masters. And so I saw what a great operation he had going and all the connections he's got there in town, and joined forces with him. And so for the last 4 years or 3 years, I've been hosting, you know, 40 or so, 40, 50 people out there. And so we've got really nice private homes, the tickets, we've got great party up at Westlake Country Club with a special guest speaker there. This year it'll be Frank Christian, the retired photographer. He was the head photographer there at Augusta National for years. He's taken all those famous black and white photos, and you know, he's been to all the Ryder Cup. He has got the greatest stories and a collection downtown, his office pictures and stuff. He's great. Brings the history back to life there, and we've got access to all the country clubs in town there if people want to play golf or have dinner reservations, and I'm there to be their host, make sure they know the shortcuts around the traffic and where the best viewing places are, and we have some pretty good parties in the evening with telling stories and camaraderie, and it's a great spring get-together.
That sounds like a lot of fun. So how do people get a hold of you?
You can just go on my website, samrandolphgolf.com, and there's a little bit of information there about the Masters. And if somebody, you know, a friend of one of your students or someone you know there is interested, I mean, I know a lot of folks have that on their bucket list, they're welcome to shoot me an email, give me a call, and we'll chat about it. You know, I just kind of send the invite out as I meet people and talk to people and give it to a few of the clubs that I'm associated with. And you know, it usually fills up somewhere, you know, late January, early February. So it's just starting to happen right now and should be another great tournament next year. And, you know, we'll know for sure that Tiger's going to be playing this time.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be another great tournament this year. Anyone wanting to get a hold of Sam, please feel comfortable to contact Sam through his website. In the next installment, Sam and I are going to continue talking about putting equipment and a variety of other topics. So we'll see you next week.